Okay, our third presentation and discussion this afternoon expands the discussion to include the global networks and audit firm governance. Shortly after arriving at the PCAOB, I was struck by a statement I read by the then head of the International Forum of Audit, Independent Audit Regulators, by Paul Boyle. Discussing the audit regulatory environment, he said, quote, "The first regulatory gap is that the firms which manage the international audit networks are currently not subject to regulation or oversight. As a first step, we should consider improving our knowledge of the structure, operations, and governance of the networks," close quote. Ever since, I have shared Mr. Boyle's concerns about this issue. In light of the fact that the largest public accounting firms, including their foreign affiliates, audit the vast majority of the global market capitalization, the influence over the audit process asserted by those running their international networks is clearly important to the smooth functioning of the world's capital markets. While as regulators representing foreign nations, we certainly have the power and the right to disagree, it would seem that we have the common goal of high-quality audits performed by independent and competent professionals for the benefit of investors. That common goal should allow us to come together to close this regulatory gap and resolve inspection and other issues. Lynn Turner has been leading the working group looking at measures that would provide a minimum level of worldwide audit quality and how regulators across the globe can come together to improve and monitor international firms' governance and performance. With Lynn on the working group are Bonnie Hill and Calvin Blake, who unfortunately can't be here but are represented, Judge Sporkin, Bob Tirola, and Meredith Williams. So, Lynn, with that, why don't you start?
Got a lawyer.
Not bonded, Lynn.
Karaoke. Can we have some music?
That was not the way forward. While we're waiting. We had six in our group, as Steve mentioned. Bonnie, Meredith Williams both had board meetings this week, so unfortunately couldn't join us today. And Calvin Blake had a hearing that he had to be at yesterday, so he's unable to join us as well. But all three of them helped us out with the ideas and contributing to the memo. There is a memo in your materials that provides greater detail and support behind what you're going to turn around and see in the slides. These are global entities, but they're not a single entity. I think this taken from the Deloitte website, and I don't mean to single out Deloitte. You could find the same type of information out at the website of any of the other firms, but it highlights how they are, in fact, independent, separate groups serving the companies they audit in each individual country. And that obviously creates some issues with respect to regulation, with respect to transparency. While they go to market as a single united firm, whenever there's a problem in a firm in one particular country, the firms in the other country seem to not know those guys anymore. It's interesting, over the last few decades, we've found that transparency and governance are key to good corporate results, good corporate performance. We've had an increase, obviously, in the quality of the governance and the independence of the governance at public companies, as well as push for transparency in governments and regulators. We've seen the same with respect to transparency, improved disclosures and all. Each of the large firms, in fact, have their own governance consulting group that goes out and consults with these public companies, discussing how important this governance, the quality of independent governance, the quality of independent oversight, and the importance of transparency is. But yeah, when we turn around and look at these firms, none of them practice what they preach. It's amazing. As we did the ACAP report and took testimony, we found, in fact, that none of the large firms were even providing GAAP basis financial statements to their very own partners. So it raised a question, quite frankly, if you can't get that type of information, how do you know if the firm's even financially stable or not? How can you say litigation will bring you down because no one can get the financial information? And when we, in fact, requested that financial information at ACAP, the firms were unwilling to provide it back to us. In Europe, we're starting to see more transparency because of the Eighth Directive. It's probably best described as a good first step. Wouldn't say it's a lot more than a good first step, but it, when you look at the reports, it is providing additional information. The firms, though, still lack the basic independence governance that most institutions have. The ACAP did recommend the transparency through the annual reports and also recommended improving governance. There was an issue, a debate at ACAP about whether the financial statement part of the report should be public or not. The two co-chairmen supported making them public. Other members, including the accounting firms on the committee, opposed making that information public. They were afraid that it might be used in litigation against them. However, as we've seen from many of the court cases, courts get that information anyway, so regardless of whether it's going to be made public through the PCLB or some other body, if there's litigation involved, people are going to get that information anyway. We did, as a group, support an annual report being filed with the PCLB, just as the ACAP recommended. It's tough to understand, especially given what we've gone through in the last couple of years, all the discussion about systemic risk, and I don't know that I'd put one of these firms in the same category as systemic risk. But quite frankly, if one of these firms were to go down, people are going to come back and ask the PCLB, what'd you know about it? And if you don't even get the financial statements, it's a legitimate question as to how you really are regulating and overseeing. And obviously, as the memo points out, Congress did give you the authority to go get that financial information. We also support the notion of improving the governance, getting some type of governing board on these firms. Richard Breeden supported that as part of SOX. It didn't make it into SOX, but I think the time for that, as ACAP recommended, has come. We also, in the sake of transparency, back to the good steps that Board Member Gelser took in urging Congress to make the whole investigative process public, we do support that. Bringing that out in public, I think one will speed up those investigations, but will have an impact on how these firms operate and behave. Bob Tirolo will come back, and I'll get Bob in a few minutes to expand on that. On the independence of the firms, we talked about the coziness, and we've just been talking about the objectivity. And is it skepticism, or is it just a lack of objectivity? I think quite often it has been just a lack of objectivity. At the end of the day, it isn't skepticism. It's just people really, in their own mind, weren't independent of that management team. We hoped when we passed SOX that we'd get a better result with the audit committee picking these people, but quite frankly, The audit committee financial expert rules got watered way down, and so there hasn't been that much of a change in the audit committees in this regard, so it probably hasn't had the impact. So we have this coziness issue. It was a very key issue to some of the members on our firms. And as we saw from a GAO report a few years back, these firms, and as we heard earlier with B of A and others, these firms, the audit firms, have been with these companies auditing them for a long, long time. 5 years back, you had a large column in that 1 to 2 years because that represented all the changes from Anderson over, about a fifth of them. We did have Big Five, now Big Four, so about a fifth of them did make the change at that point in time. But outside that, you can see some fairly, you know, 3-4 decades of being with that same company. However, after the Anderson thing, we went through a phenomenal change. Over the next 4 years, 6,500 auditor changes, only 2,300 of those from Anderson. People talked about, the GAO did a study at the time, and the GAO went out and surveyed the Big Four accounting firms, and they surveyed CFO saying, would you like to do mandatory rotation? You know, I don't think there was any surprise what the answer was going to come back from that type of survey. In fact, former comptroller GAO said it was one of the worst studies that the GAO ever issued. But it said, you know, with that, we don't want to do it because of the cost. And obviously people think about the cost. And yet, notwithstanding that cost, you had over 4,000 companies on their own decide to make a change in auditor. They decided that the cost wasn't so great that they wouldn't go through it. And we had CFOs going ahead and making the decision to make that change, which indicates that the findings in the GAO report really weren't valid. As a result, and to get to the basic issue, the basic fundamental issue that we continue to have with auditors, and I don't think we'll fix this problem until we are willing to take on this elephant in the room, is to go break that tie between the mindset of the auditor of trying to keep that company and the fees coming in from them, not unlike what we saw with the credit rating agencies, and making a clean break and getting them focused on making sure they get the job done right. And I think to do that, we've got to come back to the issue of mandatory rotation. Will there be costs? There'll be some costs associated with it. But as we've seen, the costs aren't so high that a lot of thousands of companies haven't done it. Do you have the issue of getting smart in the first year that you do an audit and getting up to speed and knowing what you're auditing? Absolutely. No question about that. But we also know from Enron and WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco, HealthSouth, all these companies that Lehman had auditors on them for decades, and yet despite all that supposed knowledge base from all those decades, they couldn't find multi-billion dollar errors. Or they found them and didn't say anything to the public, which turns around and raises the issue of objectivity again. And I think, as we heard, if we can't get past the objectivity issue with all the digitalization that's going on today, I would predict that in 2 decades out, we're going to see accountants going the same route of journalism, that the digitalization will make them no longer relevant because you'll be able to get the information and enough quality information about the data from databases, run your own models, and we won't need the audit. When we at Glass Lewis could go through those databases and find errors and restatements that the auditors on site couldn't, it gives you an indication that that's the direction that we're heading into. And so now we do start to hear more and more about, is it worth paying, you know, $100-200 million for an audit when in fact we get 4 paragraphs that doesn't give us any information? Can I run the data and the databases, especially with the tagged information, and do that myself now? And I think within the next 2 decades, we'll get to the point that if the auditors can't provide useful information, if they can't really remain objective, then they're going to go the route of journalists. And if you wonder what's going on to journalism, you just have to ask some of the people, like journalists over here. So anyway, strong believers that you need to do mandatory rotation. During that rotation, also make it to where you can't fire the auditor, so we don't get into opinion shopping. I think former SEC Chairman Breeden first suggested that. Put those two together. You'll have to do something in that first year to make sure that people can go through the transition and get up to speed. But I think it can be done. I've never seen an auditor who did an audit in the first year ever issue an audit report that says, I didn't get enough information, I didn't know what I was doing, and I assume in the PCAOB inspections of audits in the first year, you guys never came out and issued a report that said the auditor didn't find enough data or do enough. Certainly, we haven't seen that in the public report, so it doesn't appear to be a problem. On global audit quality, as we talked about earlier, if you look at IBMG and Coca-Cola, they derive a majority of the revenues, and in some cases, a significant majority of the revenues from outside the U.S. And with what we've seen with the problems with the PCAOB being able to get and inspect in countries like in the past, the U.K., France, Germany, Italy, most of the EU, let's be real, China, this has been a problem because, well, people think the PCAOB is ensuring the quality of the audits. The majority of those audits haven't been inspected. So we really don't know whether the quality is good or not. What we do know is we see the reports on China and see some very suspect audits coming out of that particular country. And for those of us who are investing, it is very important that we be able to invest in some of these countries and rely on the numbers. Those countries are having growing GDP. With that growing GDP, there's better opportunities for us to be able to get the rates of return that we need to earn the retirement benefits that people need to have to live in a respectable fashion. So as a result, we need to be able to do that. If, on the other hand, we can't get those returns there, that'll be a problem for us. So global audits are very important to us, but as I mentioned earlier today, the firm still uses the method of what you might call credentialing. They basically rely on that affiliate that is a separate legal entity, unks to itself, as we saw in the first slide, over in that foreign country. The lead partner may go to some of the countries and look at the work, but we're not seeing the type of inspection, the type of probing and supervision that you would see here in the U.S. Some of the PCAOB's own inspection reports highlight that. There's a couple of those inspection reports cited in the memo itself where the PCAOB has found that lack of supervision of international audits. So we do think you need to do something with that, and it's probably going to take a change, a move away from credentialing and to a much stronger standard on supervision. This is one of the example of one of those reports where there were material waived adjustments in a foreign country, and the local U.S. country didn't even auditor didn't even know of it, wasn't even made aware of it. It's amazing. Good inspection report, by the way. We've talked about the same problems with China. So with respect to global audit quality, going back to the first part in the annual report, getting us the information of the quality control, how the firm actually operates, some certifications around that from the executives of the firm, deal with this issue of credentialing and supervision of the foreign audits, and where you cannot get into those countries, China, France, and Germany, and inspect those audits, we'd like to see the audit report flat out come out and state that this portion of the assets and revenues were audited by a firm that hasn't been inspected by the PCAOB. Let the investors know what they're dealing with, what their risks are. Last, some of our members were very keen on improving these audits through forensic audit procedures. This was key to a couple of them. I think it applies both to U.S. and international aspects. This was a recommendation made 10 years ago, 11 years ago, now almost by the what was known as the Panel on Audit Effectiveness or the O'Malley panel. It recommended that we beef it up and start doing a better job. As we know from data that's provided by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, external audits just don't find it. Yeah, that's all you can say. They just don't find it. And this gets back to the relevance issue. You got only 4.6% of the frauds are identified by external audits. If that's all you're going to find, and you're not going to find the multi-billion dollar errors, why would I want to turn around and pay tens of millions or hundreds of millions in audit fees? It just isn't worth it. And yet what's amazing, most amazing about it, if you look at your own auditing standards, they don't require the auditor to get an understanding about the whistleblower and the tip line, which is the number one way you do find it. And my experience has been on audit committees that the auditors, unfortunately, at times, don't know enough, that sometimes have been literally clueless about what we had or did not have with respect to working whistleblower hotlines. And with us going to Facebook and social media, the hot tips aren't going to be coming in through the company's hotlines, because if you do that, you ostracize yourself and you become very public, might lose your job and certainly can't get the next job. But you certainly can go to WikiLeaks, remain totally confidential. And so we're going to have to deal with this. The world is changing. And that's going to become a bigger and bigger thing. The last thing we want is WikiLeaks finding about these problems and the auditor clueless. And yet the auditors aren't getting their hands around it. It's just an example of one thing that really needs to be taken a look at by the auditors and the auditing process. The O'Malley panel, again, in August of 2000, recommended that there be a forensic type phase of the audit work, that it be embedded in the auditing standards. There were some changes made, but because pushed back by industry, we didn't get the full flavor of what O'Malley was looking for put into the standard. And we think that needs to be beefed up. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob. Bob can talk a little bit about the
Thanks, Lynn. Bob Tirola speaking. I just want to embellish on a few things that Lynn mentioned. And I'll go back to a statement I made earlier in today about the major auditing firms having a public franchise, yet not having the requirement of public transparency that any public institution has, whether it's a publicly traded company or even a nonprofit enterprise. Institution that has to make information public through various IRS disclosures and otherwise. Yet the profession, the auditing profession, has managed to avoid that. I was part of that auditing profession, and I don't think that's right anymore. There's too much at risk, as mentioned by other task force that worked within our committee to say what Lynn said. If in the event one of the firms is unable to handle its obligations, it would put the board in a very awkward position. I want to talk a bit about the global networks. As a audit committee member of a global company, this has been a struggle. Our two audit committees I serve on both involve global networks, and we relied pretty much on the trust me principle that the U.S. firm will make good on all the work of the international network and take responsibility for it. And in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work, but the legal structure doesn't promote that. In fact, it promotes a segmentation of work liability. And that's bad for directors, and certainly bad for investors. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know how we bridge the legal structure of our global economy to solve that. But for the most part, I would say that audit committees are buying the marketing message more so than the legal fine print, and somehow we have to bridge that gap. Rotation is a an interesting question. I was the CFO of a company who had auditors for over 100 years, same firm. That had some interesting issues associated with it. Boardrooms are private places, and boards would be reluctant to share everything, if you will, outside of that boardroom, nor should they, because some of them should remain private. The investment community, though, needs to know that the relevant information with respect to financial matters is being shared with them, and rotation has a way of promoting that. The privacy of that boardroom changes a bit if there's an understanding that there's going to be a new person there every so often to hear that message, assess the message, and have some obligation to convey that message. And lastly, this issue, the issue of transparency and good governance, I think could go a long way to closing some of the expectation gap. Just by taking away the concern that investors have currently, I think directors also have to some degree, of how these firms actually operate, how they manage their affairs, whether or not they are healthy, can actually back their work with financial resources, and how in fact problems would be resolved among this federation enterprise when they in fact do occur.
I'm here to tell you a good story about an accounting firm with an outstanding fellow heading it, who some 3 years ago allowed me to test a theory that I had. And the theory was the concept of forensic in the audit. We all know that all the accounting firms have good forensic groups, but generally they're being used for people other than their own clients. And my thought was, why don't we use them for the firm's own clients? So along with a former associate of mine, Gene Goldman, and Scott Taub, who was acting chief accountant, we came up with this concept of forensic in the audit. Now, how do you don't have it in every audit, right? So you got to say, how are you going to select which audits you want it in, obvious. And what we did was we would have, at the beginning, risk assessment. We would look at the client. The auditor would look at the client. Where do they do business? What types of risks do they have? Do they do business in areas where they are, where the countries are on the list of Transparency International, of having the possibility of a lot of FCPA and other issues? Once you get to the first issue of the risk assessment, and it's determined that the client is in an area where they have these problems, then what you do is you incorporate the forensic with the financial auditor. Now, why? I mean, why can't the financial auditor do this? Why do you need a forensic? What's the reason for it? Well, the reason is simply the financial auditor is talking about materiality. He's up here. the forensic auditor usually comes in at the low level. He's looking at petty cash. He's going to be looking at things that the financial auditor is not going to look at. And so you have to combine the two together. And the forensic auditor, as he goes into the case, looks and sees if there are agents, looks and sees how they're expensing some of these, how they're treating officials in the countries where the client operates. And so you have this blending and this you have the two working side by side. Now, there are problems there because the financial auditor usually looks down at the forensic auditor, who may not be a CPA. It could be an investigator of some kind. It could be a lawyer even. And so you have to get that blend in and if it works. So rather than just come up with this concept on a theoretical basis with this outstanding leader of this accounting firm, he said, well, let's try it. And so for 3 years now, we've had a test case, and it works. He's come back to say, and we've tested it. I've been there with Gene and Scott. We've tested it for 3 years. It's not perfect. There's still problems, and yet it will work. There's no question. Now, one of the big issues was, who's going to pay for this? You know, is the accountant going to have to – the accountant absorbed it for the test period for the – but what I've learned recently is – you make money because the client needs the assurance that they're not violating the these provisions of the law, the money laundering and the FCPA. So, yes, he's willing to pay that money now so that he doesn't have to go through an investigation, whereas in one case what they had over $1 billion in costs and legal fees. So where it was thought was going to be a problem and getting someone to pay for it is no problem at all. And so the system works, and they'll be testing it, I think, one more time, and hopefully they'll roll it out. But the beauty of it is that that in an era and among a profession where it's always thought that there was a lack of innovation and a willing to be creative, it is tremendous that you find someone now who is willing to try something and doing with the really thinks the concept is good and he's willing to back it. So that's where we are now. Is this going to be should this be the standard? I hope that at some point we'll come to the PCAOB and roll it out. And, you know, I think there should be no reason why we shouldn't meet the expectations of investors. I mean, up until just a short while ago, accounting firms have disowned fraud, have said, we're not interested. We can't find it. We're not going to look for it. I think the profession now realizes they can't get that doesn't work anymore, and they've got to do something more. And while this system that we've been perfecting might not be the 100% answer, there are problems of dealing with third parties, of how you're getting access to agents' books and records and things of that kind, but we'll work it out over time. We're going to have to get new kinds of auditing standards to be able to deal with these emerging issues as they arise. But I think you're going to see something that you're going to like, because I think it's really pushing the ball forward, and I think it's going to be a boon to investors.
Steve, let me just follow up with what my two fellow panelists had to say, and maybe come back to the question that Chairman Doty raised at the end of the last session about cost. When you talk about costs, our pension fund saw tens of billions of dollars disappear in value during the Enron scandals, loss on investments. In the last subprime, as I mentioned, we saw $44 billion go down to $26 billion. And Ann mentioned similar type numbers and percentages. In fact, all investors. And that's not to blame the whole thing on the auditors, because that would be sorely misplaced, I think. Ultimately, the people who are doing these bad loans deserve the brunt of the complaint. But nonetheless, the gatekeepers did have a finger in the pie here. And when you look at costs, when you raise the question of cost, I think you need to, rather than start with the cost to a public company, I've never seen investors say we weren't willing to pay the cost to get good, high-quality information with integrity. I've never heard an investor say they weren't willing to pay for that. But what we don't hear in this town, when people start talking about cost, it's always as a vehicle to avoid doing something. It's never people starting off the equation with, what does this cost investors? And I'd urge the PCLB to reverse that paradigm for once and start off with, what was the cost to investors of what we've seen transpire in the last 10, 12 years? And when you look at those numbers and you look at any additional cost to having the auditor go ahead and do the work to provide additional information, and I think most of the information is available, it'll get QC'd to death, but most of that information does exist in those topside memos, quite frankly, and that are required by your own standards. I do agree with Joe on that, but also understand the QCing that will go on. But those costs are but a drop in the bucket to what the 100 million Americans in this country have suffered in losses. They pale by comparison. So that's my view, Jim, on the cost side. On the forensic side, I think Stanley made some very good points. When we came out of Enron, for those of us serving on audit committees at the time, we did see the audit firms starting to put forensic people on every audit, certainly any major significant audit. And that really benefited us in the audit committee in terms of what they could bring, and also their ability to turn around and challenge the auditors to think out of the box. The forensic people do a different audit. They think differently, and I think that out-of-the-box thinking is very important. It was very useful. Unfortunately, what we've seen in recent years as a cost-saving measure, as the firms have turned around and once again started to cut their fees, they've pulled those forensic auditors off of almost all of those audits. Once again, leaving us without the real in-depth type of assessment, expert assessment of fraud risks that you ought to have on the audits. And why was it done? It was done to save cost and keep the partners' draws and salaries up. And I think someone needs to turn around and take a look at why it was that the firm saw it fit to go do it, and I think rightfully so, but then all of a sudden degraded the quality audits around the globe in that respect. On the objectivity issue, probably the best example I can think of involves one of the companies that's been discussed a lot today, AIG. Of course, in 2004, Elliot Spitzer did his investigation of AIG and started to bring his action against them for the transactions that they'd engaged in, including with Jen Rhee. As part of those negotiations and the settlement, Spitzer was very concerned about the objectivity of the auditors. PwC had been their auditor for a long time. And initially, Spitzer wanted them to rotate. The chairman of the board was able to talk him into just letting him go out for a proposal. And they did. They went out for a proposal and brought KPMG and Deloitte and Touche into that process. And in November of 2007, I think I got the right year, they had a bake-off between those three firms. And they decided to keep PwC on. Within days of that announcement, PwC came out and announced that there were problems with the numbers, problems and issues with the company. And court documents have shown PwC was concerned about the valuation models by the time the second quarter Q was being worked on. If there was ever an example of where there was a serious question about the objectivity of the firm that cost investors a lot of money, that cost taxpayers one of the largest bailouts we've ever had, that is it. And if you look at the, you know, $100 to $200 billion that we had to put into that thing, the cost of rotation, the rotating the auditors on that, would have been a drop in the bucket. So small a drop you couldn't even see it compared to what we paid in taxpayer bailouts. So from that perspective, I don't think there's a cost-benefit issue. I think it is very clear. This is an issue of, does this board have the courage to take on what will be a very tough, controversial project, one that we debated in this profession for a good five decades, but we've always danced around it, and as a result of dancing around it, we've never got the basic fundamental issue solved, and I think this is a time that this board can show courage, can show leadership, can show vision, and really separate itself as being a board who did the right thing.
Thanks, Lynn. Mike?
You know, as these meetings go, it's always interesting. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge all the good work that went in by the three working groups. I thought the studies were very thorough. I thought the comments were very good, and I think this is this could lead to what Lynn said. It's an opportunity to really do something significant. One of the things that struck me, though, is that sitting at lunch, you know, the conversation at lunch frequently at these types of gatherings is actually better than the discussion around this table. Fascinating how that happens. And one of the things that came up, this really went to something Barbara said. Barbara said in her report that with Sarbanes-Oxley, we set out to strengthen independence, improve audit quality, and that it appears that we fell short of the mark in that regard. And I thought about that, and what struck me is that we made a mechanical change. It was a good change, one that I support. But what we didn't do is we didn't change behavior that has grown over decades. So what we set out to do, we didn't really accomplish, and that was to change behavior. If you step back and listen to the three reports, I think the thing that has really been discussed is Lynn's elephant in the room, objectivity. I think objectivity goes a long way to strengthening objectivity, goes a long way to addressing many of the problems that we've discussed. And my question, I have two questions for this group. The first question is, do auditors view investors as their clients? And you don't have to answer that, because I think most of you would say no, they don't. Jay Hansen actually alluded to that in his opening remarks. So if that's the case, then how do we change that behavior? How do we change behavior so that we strengthen objectivity? So my second question really is, would this group, this investor advisor group, be supportive of tackling that issue, objectivity, in a meaningful, substantive way, and really looking for, not just taking Lynn's suggestion, but looking at a range of possible solutions. Because one of the things that's interesting about audit quality is it's a little bit like a balloon. Sometimes when you push down over here, it pops up over here. So you have to be really careful about what you change and what levers you pull to make sure that you achieve the intended result without any disastrous, negative, unintended consequences. So the question I have again is would this investor advisory group support really looking, doing what Ann Simpson suggested, taking on a big project and looking at objectivity and how it's strengthened?
I don't think any one individual speaks for the investor advisory group, but we certainly welcome the input of all here. I mean, certainly with respect to myself and speaking for nobody but myself, I would, of course, welcome that. I wouldn't welcome it to the exclusion of other issues that investors have laid out on the table, but I don't see how you can divorce what we're discussing in terms of what I've mentioned, improving auditor objectivity, boosting transparency of auditor skepticism, monitoring conflicts of interest, and policing auditor independence. I think improving auditor objectivity is extraordinarily important. So once again, you asked the question of the investor advisory group. I filibustered, you know, on my personal views on it, giving people the opportunity to think it through. So now it's open season to, you know, whoever would want to answer the question. I don't know, Barbara, you had your tent up. But
yeah, I was going to talk about that anyway, so well played.
I'll take the check after the meeting, Barbara.
That's right. One of the issues that I work on that has nothing to do with auditors is fiduciary duty for brokers. But it's that same issue of objectivity. And I've had occasion as a result to listen to a number of presentations by behavioral economists who basically say, however bad you think conflicts of interest are, however negative you think the effects of conflicts of interest are on behavior, they're much, much worse. You know, you cannot solve the problem of professional skepticism without looking at the issue of objectivity. And, you know, I actually, as I recall, took some heat at the time Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed for suggesting that it didn't do nearly enough on that issue of independence, that it was, in fact, on that one issue, a fairly modest set of proposals, and that all of the really significant proposals that had been put forward to try and address that issue had, for political reasons, been taken off the table. And so, you know, In an attempt to look objective in presenting my earlier report, I didn't try to presuppose that I know the answers to all of the questions that you might find if you do a study. But I do think a lot of what you find when you get back to, you know, sort of dig in and look at details is that issues around objectivity are going to be at the heart of a lot of the problems that we've seen. And then just briefly on the issue of costs, I sort of have two ways of answering that question. One sounds a lot like Lynn's, you know, $11 trillion in household assets gone in this latest crisis, not all of which, of course, is attributable to the auditors, as Lynn said. But you can afford to pay a fair amount of money in that kind of environment if you deliver significant, meaningful improvements that would reduce those losses. On the other hand, I also, you know, there's a political answer to this question, which is that anything that you propose that raises costs will be opposed on exactly the grounds that you said. You know, you are inhibiting capital formation by making it too expensive for small companies to come to market. The point I would make about that is they're going to say that whatever you do. You know, that is, I mean, I could just put it on a tape. I can't tell you how many times I've heard it. It is used with no factual basis or with the slimmest, most manipulated statistics in order to back it up. And anything you do that looks to force meaningful change and produces business restriction will, you know, resistance will be met with that argument. So you might as well just sort of take it as a given and take it with a grain of salt.
Had yours up, and then I don't know what the order was. So I lost track.
That's fine. I'm always happy to defer to Barbara. On the question that Mike teed up, I think if you can meaningfully improve objectivity, a lot of the other problems in the profession kind of take care of themselves. I think that's a root cause of a lot of other things that we see. So I think to the extent that you can deal with that, it eliminates or at a minimum mitigates a lot of other problems. But the comment I wanted to make is I guess a question to Lynn and his group, and for the benefit of obviously the board and the SEC people. Lynn, one of your recommendations is that there be independent members on firm boards or advisory boards and no less than three. And I certainly support that. But I had a couple of questions for you, and as I said, for the other benefit of the others in the room. To the extent that this is not something that the firms have done voluntarily, there's always the risk that when you impose things on people that they don't want to do, they look for ways to comply with the letter but not the spirit of the law. So some of the things that I guess I would ask is, one, I think to do this well, there would have to be carefully drafted rules that would preclude firms from narrowly tailoring or limiting the mandate. I could create an advisory board with no real power, no real authority. I mean, if you look back to the history of audit committees have existed for long times, and we saw audit committees that never met. We saw audit committees that had one or two people on them, and they weren't independent. And, you know, obviously over time those have become tightened up. But limiting the mandate would be a problem. Putting friends and family on firm advisory boards, and I use those terms broadly when I say friends and family. Some of that is prohibited in the corporate sector, obviously, by SEC rule and stock exchange listing standards. But even with that, we see corporations, because social ties are now outlawed. And so we still see this being an issue. And, you know, obviously the chairman's gone, Jim, but I think one of the things that motivated her proxy access proposal was this very issue. And so to the extent that you're not going to have something comparable for accounting firms because they're private partnerships, I think it's careful. I think it would be important for the board, if they put this in place, that they look to make sure that who are put on those firm advisory boards are, in fact, really independent and not shills. And then the last thing, the Institute of somebody this morning talked about the UK governance code, which is now in effect, and I've talked to some people in the United Kingdom. And the firms are doing it very differently. As I understand it, Ernst & Young now has independent members on the advisory board for the whole global network, is what I've been told. And some others have done it across Europe, and some others have done it country by country. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think one of the things that's important there, one of the requirements that these independent firm board members are charged with is being the liaison between the accounting firm and the investor community. And we've talked a lot today about the need for greater involvement of investors with the audit process. So to the extent that the board did something like this in the United States, I think that's a useful feature that we've seen in Europe. So your comments on it, Lynn, would be appreciated.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Joe. I think on this particular board, you've got Chairman Doty, who has been a wonderful counselor to corporates and corporate boards, and I think between Jim and Lou and Dan, they should be able to draft a credible governance policy. Anyway, I hope they would. But I have no doubt they could, and with Jay's help, Jay's been a partner in one of the firms and knows the firms inside and out, and I would think that between those four, they could do an excellent job of crafting something. But I think the points you make, Joe, in fact, every single one of those points you make, perhaps especially the friends and family.
Hey, Lynn, thanks for excluding me.
That was actually intentional, but.
Well, he would be the governance.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, you did the stuff on the audit committees on SOX, so at any rate. But I think Joe's points are all very good points and things people should consider. But I think this board has got the talent to turn around and go accomplish that.
I think that two comments with respect to the cost versus benefit and the capital formation. I think the cost versus benefit argument, as several people have pointed out, have always been used, and they will always be thrown at us. When we talk about accounting standards, we talk about disclosures, everybody talks about how expensive the disclosures are. Then they go ahead and produce those and simply copy them over and over. It's too bad that wherever the central location is where they get that disclosure, they don't have to pay them royalties because all the firms use the same thing over and over. But that's one aspect of it. The other point I wanted to make was about the capital formation issue. That's another red herring that gets thrown at us all the time. I really don't see any empirical evidence, no studies that show me that capital formation has been impeded. In fact, as started this morning, it was pointed out that the first audits were issued in 1897 or something. I don't recall anybody requiring them then. But companies decided that the railroads decided that it would make sense. Railroads decided almost 36 years before the 1933 acts required those audits. Subway systems in New York City were going out and getting audits because they felt that would actually help. They may have been cynical for all I know, but the point is that people went out and got these audits, incurred these costs in order to facilitate rather than impede capital formation. The other point I wanted to make was in response to Mike, as he said, sometimes the conversations during breaks and lunches are quite interesting, or maybe even more so. And I think what we were talking about and what the day has shown me is that this is not a simple, single-directional, unidirectional problem or anything. That's why I said earlier the study that we think you must undertake is something that you will have to plan carefully, and you'll have to keep your eyes open as you go through it because it will suggest directions to go in. But it has to be done with a great deal of care. I think it also has to be done because, as investors, we've paid a lot for this already in terms of losses that have been listed by Barbara and by Lynn, not to mention a whole host of other places and studies that would show you how much it has cost investors. And in fact, the other point is not just the investors. I think the real question is how much has it cost the economy not having a substantive system in place?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, please, at any time, interrupt or ask any questions you like.
I don't have the sense of the of the group that the suggestion that doing the things that have been put forward as recommendations should wait on the study. In other words, I think what I'm hearing is the group believes that there are recommendations coming out of here that are ripe for consideration and some kind of addressing, handling by the board, although the study goes on. And a question or two on a couple of the comes up, but Norman, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to Mike Starr made both a very astute observation and asked a very important question. I think it underlies actually a lot of what we talked about today. I have no doubt that if there was a fourth side to our tables here today and the four vice chairs of audit from the big four firms were sitting there, we'd have a vigorous discussion about whether there's sufficient objectivity in the audit process today, and probably a lot of disagreement around that question. And ironically, as I thought about it, as I heard Mike discuss the issue, it occurred to me that in some respects, an assessment or a formation of a view about whether an audit or an audit process involves a sufficient degree of objectivity is in any respects a subjective determination. Reasonable minds will disagree because at the end of the day it comes down to its behavior. It's human conduct, and as with most things involving human conduct, what determines it is incentive structures. So I think where you come at the end of the day is to a question, among others, of whether there are consistent and uniform and sufficient incentives in place to ensure the kind of behaviors you want to see occurring regularly in an audit process, and that is the willingness to engage in rigorous scrutiny, to ask difficult questions, to demand candid and forthright answers, and to communicate results of all kinds, good, bad, and indifferent. And that, in turn, goes to a whole host of issues around audit, the structure of the profession, the structure of the firms, transparency, range of service offerings, transparency of the audit process, which we discussed earlier today, and a lot of the other issues that have been on the table today. So I think it is a vitally important question, and I think one that underscores a lot of what we have talked about and what I suspect the board will want to consider going forward. But at the end of the day, it is a profession, and professions involve people, and people are creatures whose behavior is determined in large part by incentives, and I think that's something that we in the board should always keep in mind as we talk about how to improve the audit process and bring what I think everyone would agree is the very desirable goal of increased scrutiny and objectivity to that process.
This is Gus Sauter. It may not surprise anyone that the representative from Vanguard would say costs do matter. I think any undertakings should consider cost-benefit, and I think the benefits are substantial. Joe mentioned earlier that some of this really wouldn't be very costly. You know, a lot of the analysis is being done by auditors already. Better disclosure really shouldn't be that costly. But I wouldn't throw cost considerations away. There have been studies done since the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley, which is a very costly legislation, that show a secular decline in IPO activity and at the same time an increase in privatization. So, you know, there are some costs that could be hitting economic growth because of significant regulation. Nevertheless, I think there is a huge conflict of interest when management selects an auditor. First, management is selecting the auditor. Management is paying the auditor. But management is using the investor's checkbook to write the check on. So, consequently, we have this situation where the auditor isn't tied to the investor. They're tied to management. And I wonder if there isn't a way to figure out how to tie the auditor to the investor. And could that be, I don't know if Joe was literally suggesting this, could that be setting up an investor group? And I'm thinking something different from independent board members, but an investor group whose sole function would be to hire auditors. It's perhaps dangerous to try to think of these things on the fly, but I think that it would be important to somehow culturally align the auditors with investors. And again, hopefully that wouldn't be overly expensive. So while I do agree with most of the comments here, there is a cost at which you say no. But $1 trillion worth of extra cost probably is not worth it. I'll be so bold as to say it's not worth it. But hopefully there are ways to make significant changes without incurring overly burdensome costs.
Before it goes back to the end, I did have a question about Robert Tarna's notion about firm financials. This is an area that keeps coming up. And to what extent, I think you did indicate that one of the uses of firm financials would be creditworthiness, whether there was something behind the attestation. To what extent does that really induce to a run on the bank type situation? Is it appropriate for the board to be attentive to that. We are veering away in our philosophical orientation in this country from too big to fail. Does the receipt and use of firm financials tend to pull the regulator more into a too big to fail analysis? I just ask these as questions, and I think that one of the things I am sensitive to is that there are very few public institutions that don't have audited financials. I mean, there are some, but universities have them. Labor unions may or may not. But the fact is, what use would be the appropriate use of the firm financial?
Chairman Doty, the direct answer is yes, but in a qualifying way. When boards hire auditors and Gus, the audit committee is responsible for that hiring activity. And I know people have said management, and maybe that's an indication that people around the room think management and the board are the same thing, and maybe that's, you know, maybe that is true in some cases. But when you hire an auditor, you don't have that information. It's really the trust me model that the financial wherewithal stands behind the firm. Now, because I was a partner with a firm, I know that most of the cash is distributed out on an annual basis. So the creditworthiness is really around cash flow. Should that be interrupted, problems will arise, I believe. So I think it is relevant to the system overall, to the financial reporting system and the quality of the markets, to have some indication that those who are rendering opinions over the quality of reporting have the wherewithal to stand behind those opinions.
Whether it would have mattered to Robert Tirolo, CFO, to know whether the firm had more or less cash flow and capital than someone else you were considering would be a question. In other words, would it matter to you that firm A had more than firm B, or would there be other ways firm B could show you that they would deliver a better audit? These are things I think we will eventually hit. You don't have to opine on these today. And I guess the other thing is, what difference does it make in terms of that issue of the quality of the audit, if in fact people are looking at what is really a distributable cash flow statement at year end? How does it factor into your assessment of whether the audit's good?
Actually, it's not, in my view, a factor into whether or not one firm will deliver a better audit than the other. I think that's more that consideration and judgment is more around the expertise of the firm and or the people involved with your audit. I think from the standpoint of representing a company, however, if you thought one of the prospects for performing your audit did not have the wherewithal to stand behind their work, that would be a consideration. I think that's in degrees, so it's not absolute.
Lynn, I know that this was a recommendation of ACAP and one that you feel strongly about. So if you could take a minute and just indicate how you think investors will benefit from individual firms providing annual financial statements prepared in accordance with GAAP, I'd appreciate your getting that into the record. And then we'll turn to Board Member Hansen.
Yeah, like I share the thoughts that Bob had, having been a partner as well at one of these firms. I do think any time you're starting to make your financial statements public and put information out there, that very well may have an impact on how you behave. You asked the question about how this ties to audit quality, which is a fair question from your perspective. I know there's been some diversity in views in the board about whether or not you should be a regulator of just audit quality or go beyond that. What I would tell you is, ultimately, at the end of the day, audit quality gets back to the people that you can attract, just like the quality of a law practice gets back to the quality of the attorneys you have in the
in the law of practice and your ability to attract the very best and brightest and pay the most for those. I mean, it just goes hand in hand. You can't make an assessment about that unless you're able to see how these firms are performing. All of these firms are highly leveraged, extremely highly leveraged, thin capital. Because of what Bob said, you distribute most of the money out each year because you not only want to put out the earnings, but you got to put out enough money to pay the taxes on it. So for the most part, they operate and their capital is provided by the banks that turn around and support them with their annual revolving lines of credit. Given the fact that they're thinly capitalized, that they're highly leveraged, they all have a call on their partners, though, because that, quite frankly, is where perhaps the biggest assets lie off balance sheet. It would seem to me, if I was trying to oversee that company, I'd want to know just how lever and how close they are to the edge, and I'd also like to know what they're doing in the way of investing in their people. You know, is your payroll, is the payroll of one firm running 40% of revenues, another one running 45% of revenues? Are they investing enough? Are they investing enough in technology? And quite frankly, are they generating sufficient margins to allow to make those investments and still return enough money to the partners to entice the partners to stay there and do a very good job? You can't get that type of information unless you're getting those financial statements. And for those of us who vote on reappointment of the auditors, that's a very valid piece of information. You talk about the run on the bank. You know, is it important to me to know that a bank has 10% capital versus 3% capital? Yeah, it is.
But that would be an argument about making it available to the audit committee hiring them, but not publicly available, perhaps.
No, because I'm being asked, and in fact, ACAP recommended that every public company give its shareholders a vote on the auditors. That is important information to me. When I turn around and vote on the auditor, I shouldn't be doing that in the dark. I should be doing it from an informed position. So why wouldn't I want to know the financial stability and viability of an audit firm I'm voting for and know that it's making the reasonable investments in its people? I think it's common sense that you'd want to turn around and have that information. And actually, I had this discussion with the partner of a large regional firm that audits many public companies about 2 months ago about the financials. Do you put them out or not? His biggest concern, and what this person, very good partner, very good auditor, but what his concern was that because the firms are so thinly capitalized and because they have such a huge OPEB liability, their exposure, their financial stability isn't around the liability issue for litigation, because that's dropped off the cliff at this point in time because of court cases. Their biggest exposure is the liability to their retired partners for health care and retirement. And at ACAP, despite the fact we pleaded with them to give us financial information and they refused to, the limited data that they did give us indicated that perhaps one or two of these, if you did a gap basis set of financials because of the OPEB liability, would actually have negative capital. And yet you're sitting here as five board members today and you don't know, given the significant leverage of these companies, whether one of them does have negative capital or not. How can you regulate such a significant public franchise if you can't even tell one of the companies, one of the four that audits most of these public companies, is sitting there with negative capital? And you can't know unless you get that information. If it ever blows up, there won't be any place for you to run and hide, because the public will be coming back and saying, why weren't you getting this? Why didn't you know it? And there's no answer to that question. That'll be on the front page of the New York Times, and there's just no answer. There's no rock you can go and hide under when that one pops. So, just a thought.
Board Member Hansen speaking. Question I want to frame for a number of you. I've heard a couple different comments about the use of various specialists that auditors need to use. Lynn, you mentioned forensic auditors. Judge Sporkin mentioned the same thing. One of the most difficult areas in the audits of the big banks is the evaluation of the complex financial instruments that you need the top people on earth to help value those. And there are other examples as well. Norman, I think you had mentioned the need for subject matter experts in the firms to be involved. And another area this comes up is in income taxes, that the line auditor has a really difficult time with income tax. They need the help of the specialists in that area. In the IT area, that's another example. Actuaries are another example. It's been my personal experience that bean counter auditor types like me kind of like doing that for a living. Folks that are highly specialized in areas of financial instruments and income taxes, they don't like being an auditor, otherwise they'd be an auditor. They like doing their craft. So one of the challenges is they have to be able to do their craft to stay current as well as have the skills to help the auditors. So that's one of the areas where I'm just kind of curious as to your thoughts about how do you reconcile the need that the auditors have to have those kind of people readily at hand to help them do their job in these most complex areas. Yet the cry is coming out that with the split of the audit practices and the other consulting services, things like that, the arguments that were coming up 10 years ago are front and center on the table now. I'm just kind of curious as to the connection between those two, that if the firms do not have ready access to those people that are the best, how are they going to accomplish what we're identifying as a really, really significant need for those people to be involved in the audits?
Jay, and you're right, that did come up a lot during the discussion over the auditor independence back in 2000. The problem was that, for the most part, the auditors and those experts just don't get along in the firms. And so you didn't have that exchange of information going from the consulting side, if you will, into the audit side. And the firms all still to this day still have the consulting practices, and they're growing. They just don't do it for the very same companies that they audit. So in that context, it shouldn't be an issue because the expertise is there and should be available. The real question is, why isn't that, as we talked about with the forensic people, why isn't that expertise inside the firm being brought into the audit? And I think that's a legitimate question. The other thing is, when you use outside experts, either in the actuarial area or others, all too often the auditors just take that report, plop it in the work papers, tie it out, and don't really do what the standard requires them to do with respect to that report. There's a fairly decent standard, I think, from the old Auditing Standards Board in that regards, and I think in that area, I think more than a standard issue, it's a performance and enforcement issue, but it really ultimately gets down to, either internally or externally, are the auditors putting the experts that they really should be on those audits.
And Lynn, I agree that historically it's been a challenge of the auditors and the consultants playing nice together, and I think it's gotten a lot better. I think the larger engagement teams use the specialists. They have no choice because they need them to understand the complex.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that, Jay, because if you look back over the large banks and the valuation issues that were there at Lehman and at Citigroup and the likes, I would turn around and raise a serious question. AIG is another prime example. I would raise a serious question as to whether or not there was really an independent, unbiased view that came into the pricing of those assets. I think history tells us that there were serious deficiencies there. So
I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm just saying directionally it's better than it had been from my direct experience as well as experience talking to a lot of the other firms. And my concern, to restate it, is if we go down this road, as some are calling for, to effectively split the firms into being audit-only firms, that's only going to exacerbate that problem of having the best expertise available to the auditors.
You know, Paul Volcker has been a big fan and vocal proponent of that, and I value Paul's counsel tremendously. I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure I would agree with you. I think you could go get that expertise, and what you'd have to weigh is, would you get a more thorough, robust audit because it was a firm that was very focused on the public franchise but had to go get outside experts and bring them in? Or would you have a better audit where there were conflicts internally and maybe less objectivity on the part of the auditor as a result of that? You know, it's a good issue, good question. I'm not sure, but what Paul isn't right about it, and it comes back to the question that someone raised. Oh, I know, it was Mike. Mike raised the very first question. Who do you view as your client? If you go back and look at that initial slide that I put up from Deloitte & Touche, from their international headquarters on their website, they give you the answer to that question. It is not investors. They talk about their clients. It's the businesses. As long as you have that mentality, then I think Volcker may absolutely be right. And Paul isn't a pure audit firm. He has no problem with bringing in some expertise and having that resident. But when you've got the mentality that these firms have demonstrated, and then they're telling you who their client is, they aren't asking, they're telling you, that raises a very significant issue. And back to Mike's question about the overall issue of a real serious look at how do you come up with a remedy here. You know, most people have talked about mandatory rotation. They've talked about perhaps having the stock exchanges through some type of fee arrangement, pick them and all. I think what Gus mentioned is the key. You got to build that link between the investor somehow and the audit firm. I personally believe that if you take the ACAP recommendation and the SEC adopts requiring companies or have the listing requirements that auditors appoint the auditor, and then you go with the mandatory rotation, I think that's the easiest, most cost-effective way to do it that there is. And we've studied this thing for 50 years. I agree with Chairman Doty. Another study is a waste of time, you know, at this point in time. We've studied this thing to death. If people can't figure out, given all the studies, how to do it at this point in time, then we're probably a lost cause. And 20 years down the road, the digitalization will take care of that. But I think the real key thing is the answer has to come back to what Gus said, and there has to be that link. That first slide has to change. That first slide has to be transformed into when they're talking about clients, they're talking about investors.
Brandon, we haven't heard from you for a while, so why don't we go over to you?
Oh, just a small point. I thought Board Member Hansen's description of the problem is correct, and it's an ongoing one. The only thing I was going to add was it's not unique to the accounting firms in the sense that regulators have that on a routine basis. We have that when you're trying to build a risk team that's going to evaluate what your traders are doing. Broker-dealers or old broker-dealers had it when they'd lose traders to hedge funds. Unfortunately, the answer, at least in our experience, is you got to pay people the right amount of money, and you've got to create a career path, and you can't do it overnight. Whether or not structural division is the way to get it, I'm not sure. I wouldn't opine on whether structural division ensures that, but I am confident that if you don't have a career path and you don't have the right amount of money that you're paying them, you're not going to get the talent that you need in parallel, because then you've got to try and create a culture where they're on a par and willing to talk seriously to people and be listened to.
Yeah, well said. That was my point.
Mike?
I just want to correct one thing when I asked my question. What I envisioned was not a study. What I envisioned was a study with a call to action. So I don't want another study that just sits on the shelf someplace and gathers dust. I wanted to share two things, a couple of thoughts from lunch. Tony and I had a discussion about the importance of words. And there are two examples I want to share with you that underscore the importance of words, and both of them come from a speech that Jim Croker gave at the SEC. The first is that it's responsive to the question, do auditors consider investors their clients? When you look at the auditing literature, in fact, you look at the literature of the PCAOB, it refers to the client, meaning the businesses that are audited. And I would simply submit, as Jim submitted at the SEC conference, that we should change that phrasing to talk about the companies that auditors audit and not refer to them as clients. So that's the first example. The second example, let me take you back a step. The code of conduct for AICPAs has four either key phrases that are either words or phrases. They are integrity, objectivity, due professional care, and public interest. Several times today, in referring to my profession, if I can call it that, people have talked about the accounting industry. If you really believe in that code of conduct, as I do, and you really believe that auditors have a duty to the public, then I think it's more appropriate to refer to the accounting profession as a profession, not an industry, because I don't think an industry has a duty of care to the public. Thank you.
Well, Mike, how do you bring it back to becoming a profession when so many people now are associating it as an industry?
You lead.
Yeah.
You lead. That's how.
Well, I'm speaking for myself once again. I think you put your finger right on it, and Jim did as well, and the chairman. And that is, I think, that a lot more attention has to be paid to the fact that auditors should view their investors as their clients. I don't think that's the case right now, and I think that does have to be changed. Jim?
I just had a follow-up for Lynn. I think, one, Lynn, Robert, Judge Sporkin, great presentation and I think great thoughts. The one area I wanted to follow up on was, particularly as it relates to the issue of transparency, whether the group gave any thought to greater transparency around the inspections and the findings, whether that's part one and to the company under audit, so their audit committee, is there enough transparency there? And then part two, of course, is non-public, but nothing precludes a firm from making that information public. And, of course, somebody with a public responsibility and a public interest could go that further step of making that part two, quality control questions and concerns and criticisms, public, and of course that could drive greater accountability on the part of the firm for responding to those concerns. So I don't know if the group thought about that.
Actually, in the very first phone call, one of our members who serves on a number of audit committees raised the concern that in that capacity, they had a very difficult time getting information regarding what the quality of the audit was on a global basis. It was almost impossible to get. That was some comment that was made in the very first phone call. And I, having served on and chairing an audit committee of a global company like that, I would agree with that. So I think that's a very valid point. We don't have it in the recommendations, obviously. I would turn around and say that when the reports first started coming out, there were discussions amongst audit committee members about trying to get these. And I believe actually at the very beginning, one or two of these reports actually got turned over to an audit committee, as I recall. But then it seemed like the Big Four got together and squelched that. And so since then, they haven't been forthcoming. There's no question that there is nothing that precludes a Big Four firm, if they really want to be transparent here, if they want to walk the talk, so to speak, that they could, in fact, go allow that and give it to audit committee members. But they have chosen not to, which is unfortunate. It's why you got to be, you know, when they talk about everyone being transparent, it seems like everyone needs to be transparent but them. It would be great if they would change that view and start to be thinking out of the box and becoming more open and transparent. I just think these are animals that, by the nature of how they're operated and run and how they pick their leadership, the chances of that are not high. And I think that's, I think Steve knows this well. That's a point that myself and former SEC Commissioner Goldsmith have been very vocal on, that we think these ought to be made public. You need to change the legislation. So,
Tony. And then I indicate to a number of people here that we wrap up at 3:30 or close to it. So why don't we begin to
I'll be brief. I just wanted to mention that when I said that costs don't matter as much, what I meant was that relative to the benefits, they don't. The second point I'd like to make is in response to something Gus said, that there's been a secular decline in IPOs. I think part of that, I don't know if I saw the same studies, but I've seen some. And I left those studies with a feeling that they could have been written and actually designed a lot better, because they did not acknowledge or include the change in private equity acquisitions that took place. They did not take into account the change in M&A activity in the same period. And they did not take into account a very common thing in on the West Coast, where a lot of private companies are being gobbled up by the companies that they are doing little bits and pieces of work for. So I don't know that there has been. I'm not sure about the relationship there between causality and correlation between the advent of SOX and you know, whether there actually has been a decline. Jay Hansen had asked about, mentioned about different experts, and Brandon responded to it. And I think the point there is that these companies, the audit firms, need those experts. They need to use them. That's the cost of those experts, whether they are acquired through a career path or whether they're rented every by the hour or something like that. I don't mean to be offensive using the term rented, but I'm just saying that if you do it that way, I don't care. The point is that it's part of the cost of the audit and it ought to be included. If they're not using them, and the only thing that the only way that they seem to be able to survive is by having a separate consulting firm, then I think, you know, this goes back to Lynn, to EITF 0021, and now to 081. I think somebody's not doing separation and allocation correctly. And, you know, that's all I would say with respect to, I think it's absolutely critical that they have these the different expertise that you listed, and it should be part of the cost of doing the audit.
My tent actually went back up when the chairman was asking questions, and I will resist the temptation to comment on all the other issues that have come up since then. Contrary to what Lynn said, I'm pretty sure you didn't say you thought a study was a waste of time. But I think you did ask whether you needed to wait for a study before you acted. And I think there are two separate sets of issues. There are issues that have been studied to death. The ACAP report has a number of recommendations that were based on extensive study. And so there's no need to go back and restudy the things that we've studied in order to justify acting on things that have been well researched and thought out. There are, I think, another set of issues that where we don't know, you know, everything that we need to know what the recommendations would be. And that's where, you know, I think it would be wise to start with some analysis. On the issue of financial statements, one of the things that we should have learned from the financial crisis, and this relates, perhaps is a less colorful way of saying something that Lynn said, is we do not want to discover that these firms are too big to fail when they're at the point of failure. And right now, you're flying blind. you know, you're very much in the position that you could find yourself where things are falling apart and you're dealing with a firm that's you know, coming apart, and you didn't know because you didn't have adequate transparency. And so, you know, I think there's an incontrovertible case for the regulator having access to that information. But I also think Lynn is right. You know, if the sort of continuing theme here is that we want investors to be the ones who are being reported to, if we want them to take more ownership of this process, part of that is getting them more involved in these decisions about hiring and firing the auditor, and part of that requires having greater transparency about the financial condition of the auditor.
Brandon, I thought that you and Tony and Barbara, your group was recommending in terms of the study, a study of what went wrong. And is essentially, I think your words, Brandon, although I don't have them in front of me, but you wanted to have, when you first brought it up at the first meeting, an autopsy. And that's essentially what you're talking about. It's a selective autopsy of what went wrong. Am I correct in that? Or maybe I think that maybe the chairman may have
a question on this in terms of between Tony and Brandon and Barbara. I think we may need some help.
I think I understand. I take a clear message away that what's wanted is a well-designed focus study on why auditors in major financial institutions that had these problems in this particular era felt that they could issue clean audit opinions and had none of the constraints of going and calling, sounding a warning to a toxin to the audit committee, and that has to be structured. I do not want this discussion as elevated and I think as illuminating as it has been to end on the issue of the auditor financial statements. But Barbara, if we are going to be what I will call a stringent regulator, a regulator who is insisting on accountability if you violate rigidly imposed standards, one would say we do not, if you have this simple mission idea that one takes away from the SEC, for example, one would say we do not want to be petitioned by a company that is doing the wrong thing and taking in audit clients by the argument that we cannot pull the plug, that we cannot sanction that client, we can't end their ability to take clients because this is going to be the one network member of the firm that pulls the whole firm down. We don't want to be seen to be thinking primarily about whether this firm can take another $1 million penalty. That seems to me to be the dilemma here. In other words, I do think that there is intense competition in the audit profession. I don't think we know where that's going to lead. And I would like to be where I think Arthur Levitt and the commission and others were when the competition was between, by analogy here, the automated market of NASDAQ and the institutional auction market of the NYSE. And Brandon and the team at that time were very careful not to put their thumb on the scale and determine that outcome, you see. And I am concerned that this is an area I think demands a lot of further exploration among wise heads, because I'm concerned that the question that you're posing about why didn't you do something has a simple answer now, and that is it isn't our business. We're not the business model renovators of an accounting firm, an auditing firm. I'm concerned that that answer then is complicated if, in fact, there was something which the firm asked us to do that involved suspension of standards, suspension of accountability. That's the dilemma. I think we do not now have, as a board, a moral hazard in regulating audit firms. What concerns me about the financial statement question is that it implies inserting ourselves into a moral hazard position. That's philosophically the way it reads. And I do hear, though, what Robert Trolla says about the fact that, you know, that people might want to know if you're in a negative capital position, if you're the audit committee chairman, whether they hire you. My impression is not that's not the way audit committees make those decisions. But that's just to explain why I find this to be a very difficult subject.
Right. Can I just a couple of points. One, I agree. I don't want you making decisions about disciplining firms based on their financial condition. My point is, you will be asked to make those decisions. And it came up in the KPMG tax shelter case. There were press reports of people saying, well, we can't discipline KPMG because, you know, we can't afford to lose another audit firm. So that issue arises regardless of whether there's transparency or not. If there's transparency and you know what's going on, you're actually in a position to make the audit firms do some things to get in a better financial condition, including one of the ideas that's floated around at the living will notion. But I do think, I mean, I think, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful, but I think you're kidding yourself if you think you don't have a moral hazard now, because the issue will present itself when it's presented itself, and it won't matter that there was a logic behind the position that you took at the time.
That's a telling point. This is a discussion we're going to have to continue. I do think that we answered, or we spoke to this at the top of the meeting, in a sense, that in fact I do not know of a single regulatory civil action that ever sunk a major accounting firm. See, on the other hand, If you're telling me that if looking at an accounting firm that I think is shaky, that Jay Hansen tells me is shaky, we should send its clients elsewhere, we should go and ask the Treasury to provide financing. And this, by the way, is I think what Mr. Bernier has in mind, that the government would provide sort of a cushion so that audit clients of KPMG in Germany would go over to firms, a consortium of local firms in Germany that would audit them. I think these are ideas that are not well conceived, but I acknowledge to you we will have an argument at that time. If that happens, we will have an argument. I do not believe that we're in a position right now to structure an orderly plan of liquidation for a global accounting firm. It's just, it seems to me to be beyond the ken of any regulatory institution. And in fact, I think one of the great disappointments that has come out of this financial crisis by the American public is that we have demonstrated the incapacity of the Fed to do this for banking institutions. The Fed has lost credibility over this. But this is to tell you why I find the issue difficult. It's not to foreclose further discussion on the issue.
And I wanted to ask a question along those lines. And first of all, I share, Barbara, your concern and Lynn's your concern on this subject. And I think it is an extremely difficult issue. I don't want to end the day without discussing or getting any ideas as to whether or not anybody here has any concerns about the issue of concentration in the public company audit market. It's been a very hot topic. It's raised repeatedly by the European Commission. We have a highly concentrated profession. BDO, for example, in its response to the European Green Paper, recommended, among other things, the outlawing of all artificial intervention by third parties, e.g. lenders, and the appointment of statutory auditors through restrictive clauses, or lending processes which discriminate in favor of borrowers appointing particular audit firms or members of a particular group of audit firms. And Grant Thornton and others had similar concerns, as did others who responded to the European Union. I'm wondering whether anybody here shares those concerns and has any ideas whatsoever in terms of how to promote competition.
You know me, I always have opinions, so I'll just jump in. I actually see this issue differently, and perhaps in part because I've spent a lot of time in the last 18 months working on credit rating agency issues. Competition, increased competition without increased independence, is likely to occur on terms that are not beneficial to investors. If there's more competition for business and it's competition to win management's favor, we're not going to be happy with the results. So while I do have concerns about the degree of concentration that exists, including for this issue that I think there has been, and I've been very encouraged by the chairman's comments, I think there has been a reluctance to discipline the big audit firms because of the sense that they're too big to fail. I think you need to think very carefully about what happens when you get competition and it promotes a race to the bottom.
I would just quickly second Barbara's comments, and I do want to note that I think from the council's perspective, one area that we have concerns that may actually further concentrate the industry is the issue of convergence of accounting standards. And the simple fact is I'm not certain that the mid and small cap companies have the capabilities to move in that direction, at least rapidly, and I think it gives really a competitive advantage to the big four, which could further sort of exasperate, the perception that there's far too much concentration in the industry or profession. Mike?
I think you have to give people the information you need to in the marketplace so that they can force the firms to compete on quality. Currently, that information is just not out there. And so they're competing on fees at this point in time. And I think if you go to some type of mandatory rotation tied to forcing the auditor to tie into the investor, as once again, as Gus mentioned, and in that annual report, you start requiring disclosure with respect to information so people can differentiate on a quality basis, then I think you'll start to have greater competition around the right issues, which would mean you'd have to provide that information out there. And the quality control factors as were proposed to the ACAP to be disclosed. Absent that, there is nothing you're going to do to change the current environment of the big four and then probably the next couple of firms. There's just such a huge magnitude difference and so much capital or volume and size advantages to those four that the others just literally cannot, will not, never will have a chance of catching up with them.
Well, to begin to wrap up, we said when we scheduled this that we'd give each member an opportunity in closing to put any issues on the table before us or make any closing comments. So, Joe, first of all, thank you very much for that superlative presentation earlier on. I thought you did a terrific job, and you and your group certainly spent a ton of time at it, and it's very much appreciated. I think maybe the best way to summarize the discussion is with the question that last May, I think, Lynn, you told us Warren Buffett used to ask when he was on the audit company's audit committee, and that is, what is it that the auditors know that if they were investing in this company, they as investors would want to know and have out there publicly? I think that was a telling comment, and I think that you addressed a number of those issues in your presentation, but why don't we start with you and go around the table and we'll finish up.
Yeah, I think this was an extremely good meeting, like our first meeting, Steve. I think the only comment I'd make, and this is really for you and the rest of the board, is I think these get-togethers, this is a very unique group. Not leaving myself out, I don't want to give myself credit, but I think it's a very good group. I think it has very good perspective. I think the involvement today from the SEC was very helpful, and I would just encourage you to have a more regular schedule now that there's a full slate of board members in place.
Robert Tirola here. I also think this was a very informative meeting, and it was good to hear the views of the board members as we focused on these various topics. I think you have an opportunity to improve the system as well as improve the profession, not just the quality of it, but the financial. The financial benefits of it, because I think you could move toward a relevance model that is to their benefit as well as to investor benefit, and I think you can create a win-win.
Mike, and I want to say to Jim and Brian and to you, thank you very much for participating today. We look forward to our ongoing relationship with you, and if you have any comments, we welcome them.
Nothing to add other than to thank you, Steve, for having us here, and I agree with you. I look forward to ongoing discussions. Thank you.
Steve, I'd say the interaction with the board this week today has been great. In the past, the board hasn't been as active and questioned and all, so I very much so enjoyed the interaction and thought it was good, and hope we'll have the same type of interaction at next week's SAG. So, but with that, I think... you know what the issues are. I think you got a good handle around what the issues are, and I look forward to seeing what the board does.
I do congratulate you again for an outstanding meeting. Maybe we ought to consider the next time hearing from the auditors.
Judge, I believe deeply in transparency, and so we'll take that, I think, under advisement at the board, but I have no problem whatsoever at any time not only hearing from investors in an open meeting, but from the profession in an equally open meeting.
As Mike said, we were talking about words, and I'll use one right now. Given all the praise for this committee, we're bordering on hagiography now, and I... not into idol worship, so I won't take it over there. But it has been a good meeting. I appreciate the opportunity to do this, and I'm certainly more than happy to continue and help in any way possible. Thank you for the opportunity.
Steve, nothing further on the substance of today's discussions, which have been wonderful. It is great to see all five chairs occupied and occupied by men of such skill and obvious interest in all that we're doing. I want to thank you, Steve, for your stewardship of this process. I've been members of other advisory boards and groups in the past, and you know, all too often the model is you meet two or three times a year and everyone comes and there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm, and then it sort of goes flatline until the next time you meet and there's energy and enthusiasm and it kind of falls off again. That doesn't happen here, and that's a tribute, I think, to you and your work. I was very pleased both last year as these things occurred, but to hear your recap this morning of the significant work that was done in the immediate aftermath of our meeting last year to follow up on the issues that were discussed there, and I am optimistic that the same will be true here and that you'll not hesitate to certainly call on us for further input as the board moves forward, and do hope that we'll be having occasion to gather again in the not distant future. Thanks.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to participate today. I very much enjoyed the comments from the board, from all the members as well. And really, I'm excited about the prospects that we can get better information for investors. I think that's what it's all about.
Steve, just wanted to thank you again. I think there's a lot to report back to the chairman when she left. She said she wanted to hear back. There's a lot to report back, and really look forward to working constructively as you take leadership in this area.
I thank the PCOB board and staff and the SEC staff for spending the time today. You both have, or both agencies have, the important mission of protecting the interests of investors, and I do think that investor voices too frequently are not maybe articulated, perhaps we're not vocal enough or visible enough on some of these policy debates. So I think this committee is very special, that this is a group of investors trying to propose reforms reflecting the needs of investors. So, Norm, I'm going to follow your comments, and not only am I looking, I think I just want to urge the board to act on those issues that I think have been studied for many, many years, in some cases decades. Let's make sure that we're taking the lead here in the U.S. as opposed to waiting for other regulators to act, and to methodically, but I think aggressively, study those issues that need to be studied. And I very much look forward to hearing the progress report at the next meeting.
Yeah. Hi, Barb Roper. I second everything everyone said. I mean, I really do appreciate the time all of the PCAOB board members have taken, and the attention the SEC staffers, to spend essentially a full day listening to us express our views. I have almost a second career as an investor advisory board member. Feels at times as if it's half my time in various different capacities. And, you know, I can't recall a time when I've seen one, as someone else pointed out, the immediate responsiveness to the board after our previous meeting, which I think helps to inform the degree of energy that people brought to this meeting. When you know that you're talking and it doesn't just sort of echo away down the halls, that it gets serious attention, that really makes a difference. And I thought this was terrific. So thank you.
Brian Croteau, and I'll just follow along with Jim and Mike in really thanking you, Steve, for inviting us today, and to the full board, really commending you in the group here today. I think a lot of really excellent dialogue as we think about audit quality and improving audit quality for the benefit of investors. I think really getting at identifying what are the real problems we're trying to solve, what are the root causes of those problems, and what are the right next steps. And there's really a lot to think about coming out of today's meeting. And so really thank everyone for that participation. In particular, I thought a lot of the input from the survey on the auditor's reporting model will be very helpful to the PCAOB standard setting project in this area. So really look forward to continuing our work together with the IAG and with the PCAOB on projects coming out of the discussions today. So thank you.
Well, I think a lot of the momentum that we brought today was as a result of Dan's efforts and leadership in terms of the list of priorities that he met. Dan, I don't know whether you or other board members want to make closing comments.
The only thing I'd say is sitting here thinking about all the things that were on our agenda already and then all the additional ones you've added today, we're going to be very busy over the next 6 months.
I just like to say, listening to all this today, it seems to me our job is really quite simple, and it's simply to be worthy of you.
And I before letting the chairman wrap up, I want to thank all of you again. I think you put a ton of effort into it. It's easy for us, at least speaking for myself, to spend a day listening to you. I welcome it. Sometimes I like to hide behind the umbrella of the ideas that you bring to the table and lay a foundation. So that I can be supportive or, in those instances, non-supportive, but I certainly like to hear it. And I especially want to thank Joanne Hindman, who has been invaluable helping us on all aspects of today's meeting, both substantively and organizationally. So, Joanne, it could never have happened without you. Appreciate it very much. And, Mr. Chairman, I leave the closing remarks to you.
I'll cede my time to the chairman.
I thought you gave me the nod that you didn't want to speak.
I really have nothing to add except to say thank you to the, as we, I said last night, to the investor advisory group, that there may be a group that we talk to who is as important as this one, but there isn't anybody that we talk to in the year that are more important than this group. And you're doing a great public service. Thank you all.